That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient. Comfortable. Ah.
On the Science Revolution, has the Georgia governor rolled out a new death panel coronavirus plan? Dr. Andrew Glickson is here on coronavirus versus climate extinction. While we're dealing with COVID-19, we're also hurtling toward extinction. Dr. Justin Frank drops by saying Trump could see dead bodies from coronavirus and just step over them. What? Also, Greg Palast explains the secret history of the Deepwater Horizon, BP's second blowout. It's the 10-year anniversary for Deepwater Horizon's debacle. Find the Science Revolution wherever fine podcasts are available. You know, when Brian Kemp, the governor of Georgia, first issued his order, and this is a quote from his tweet, "We will allow gyms, fitness centers, bowling alleys, body art studios, barbers, cosmetologists, hair designers, nail care artists, aestheticians, their respective schools, and massage therapists to reopen their doors this Friday, April the 24th. So he lays this out. And I'm looking at this list and going, I don't see any companies on that list that are big corporations that shovel money to Republican politicians. Everybody I see on that list is a small business and generally hanging on by their fingernails, small business, right? You know, barber shops and things like that. Yeah, there may be some national chains of gyms and fitness centers and bowling alleys, but by and large, in most parts of the country, these are locally owned businesses. So what's the deal here? It seems that every business on Brian Kemp's list, now that he has issued this executive order saying that they can stay open, those particular small business owners and their employees may well no longer qualify for unemployment insurance in Georgia or other forms of state relief. We're seeing this strategy in Georgia be replicated in other Republican-controlled states. Keep in mind, states can't issue money. The federal government can just print money. The Fed is doing that like there's no tomorrow right now. The federal government can also borrow money. We've borrowed more than our GDP so far since Reagan started this debt binge. When Reagan came into office, our national debt was $800 billion, 8/10 of $1 trillion. And he tripled that to $2.4 trillion. And then it's just been off to the races ever since. States can't do that. They have to actually raise the revenue to pay for the things they're paying for. And so how do they pay for basically relief programs for unemployed people? They have to raise taxes. And the billionaires who fund Republican governors all across the United States, and make no mistake, they are funded by groups of billionaires. The billionaires who fund these Republican governors all across the states don't want to see their taxes go up. Most states have a local billionaire, and every state has a local right-wing group that's been funded by a national group of billionaires, many of which Charles and David Koch put together back in the day. You know, Republican governors live in terror of these right-wing billionaires and their so-called think tanks and their pressure groups and their lobby groups. So once again, Republicans are putting the interests of rich people and big corporations ahead of the people of their own states, and in this case, ahead of the small businesses in their own states. There's no way that a cosmetologist or a massage therapist or a barber or hairdresser can do those jobs from 6 feet away. It can't be done. But they can certainly get sick and maybe die, and then they're definitely no longer on the unemployment rolls. Is this the new Republican death panel, basically? Has Brian Kemp rolled out the GOP's new plan to deal with the coronavirus? Let's just wipe out the small business people. You know, why? Well, I think that this is just a desperate ploy to not have to pay these people. I mean, it's very straightforward. Dan Patrick is talking about this, the lieutenant governor of Texas. You know, life is overvalued, right? And George Chidi, who is a reporter, he says, if there's no state order calling for businesses to be closed, the people who are unemployed can no longer claim that their unemployment is involuntary. You know, they can't maintain social distance. Notice that there's no banks on that list. There's no software firms on that list. There's no factories. You know, there's no big businesses, big hotel chains, things like that. They're not on that list. The businesses on the list are not only staffed by relatively poor people, they're by and large owned by kind of the top end of the bottom end of the American workforce. These are people who can maybe scrape together $10,000, $20,000, $30,000 to start a small business, but they're not rich like the people who fund the Republican Party. And so they don't have the money to hire lobbyists to give money to Brian Kemp and other Republican governors. Has the Georgia governor rolled out a new death panel? Is this the new Republican death panel plan or program? It's starting to look like it. On the line with us today is Dr. Andrew Glickson. He is a climate scientist, research scientist with the Australian National University. Recently wrote a piece published by The Conversation about Earth hurtling toward a catastrophe worse than the dinosaur extinction while we're all obsessing on the coronavirus. Dr. Glickson, welcome to our program.
Yeah, thank you very much.
You note that you are an earth and paleoclimate scientist, and you've spent years, perhaps most of your life, looking at climate changes and mass extinction and the relationship between the two. And you mentioned the two most recent, the PETM and the one that probably most people are familiar with as the end of the dinosaurs. Can you give us a sense of what happened during those two extinctions, 55 and 66 million years ago?
Yeah, okay. Well, KT, the impact event, the asteroid impact, has released massive amounts of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere over a period which has been estimated as about approximately 10,000 years. In the case of the Paleocene-Eocene thermal maximum, a bit longer than that, but still, this causes, in the first case, a major, major mass extinction of more than 60% of genera, living genera have perished. In the second instance, the PETM, the extinction was less abrupt, but still major, mostly in the oceans. And it comes to show composition of the atmosphere can do to the living world, to species. Even though the rate now of the release of carbon dioxide is more than an order of magnitude faster, the reason is the rise in temperature consequence on carbon dioxide release. This immediately alerts us to the destructive consequences of the release of a changing transfer in the composition of the atmosphere at such an extreme rate.
So in other words, we're pumping carbon dioxide or carbon equivalent products, methane and whatnot, into the atmosphere at a rate that is at least 10,000 times faster than the two previous extinctions? Do I have that right? 10,000 years versus maybe 1,000?
10,000 faster. 10,000 is length of time, the number of years. It's at least an order of magnitude faster at the present time.
What does this mean for the larger animals and the apex predators like us humans?
You change the composition of the atmosphere, you change the temperature, you change most other parameters, including events such as fires and storms and cyclones, and all the consequences of increasing temperatures in on land and in the oceans. If you increase it gradually, that's one thing, but if it's increased abruptly, many species cannot survive.
You mentioned in your article that one of the things that might have caused the extinction 55 million years ago, the PETM, could have been a methane burp. Are you talking about like the clathrate gun hypothesis, where the oceans warmed up enough that the essentially frozen methane or methane frozen in crystal ice crystal lattices began to change phase, move from solid to gas and essentially came into the atmosphere? Or was that more like a melting of the permafrost and the tundra?
That it was methane is suggested on the basis of the isotopic composition of the carbon which has been released at the time. a light as a topic composition, low 13 to 12 as a topic composition. Now, the source of the methane is still a problem. It was a massive injection, even though it went over 10,000 years, or more than 10,000 years, which in terms of the biosphere was very fast, but still not as fast as what's happening now. Compare it, or when you look at it in perspective of what's happening now, we have many hundreds of billion tons of methane locked in the permafrost in Siberia and Canada and generally in the Arctic, which is already being released at very high rates. We now have close to 2,000 parts per billion of methane, which is powerful greenhouse gas. It's more powerful than carbon dioxide by a large factor. When you look at the comparison, we are releasing, or the permafrost melting is releasing methane now at a rate which is once again faster than what happened during the geological events.
What will the world look like for our children and grandchildren?
We cannot tell, of course, that we don't have a crystal ball. But many species cannot survive such an extreme change in the composition of the atmosphere. There will be some which can survive, but there will probably be very primitive forms of life, as to mammals and so on. They suffer badly. No one can tell exactly to what extent, but they will suffer.
My wife and I took a walk today along one of our country's major rivers, and there was a long stretch with a lot of flowers that were blooming. And 50, 60 years ago when I was a child, those flowers would have been covered with bees and flies. The air would have been filled with swallows, insect-eating birds. There would have been butterflies all over the place. We saw two swallows in the 40-minute walk. We saw one bumblebee, and all the insects seemed to be gone. Callers of mine, our program is broadcast nationwide. We get a lot of truck drivers calling in, and they're telling stories about how 20, 30, 40 years ago, as they drove across lush areas like Michigan or the American South, they would have to stop every 5 or 6 hours to clean the bugs off their windshield. Now they can go a week without cleaning their windshield. We've heard about the insect holocaust. Are these all the early warning signs that we are approaching biological disasters?
That's a part of it. Insects are affected. It was generally thought that some insects are resistant to climate change. But even here in Australia, or at least where I am, there are fewer insects, fewer flies, fewer mosquitoes. It's hard to say why the rise in temperature is affecting them to this extent, because, of course, there are a lot of insects in tropical regions. But it seems, as a direct observation, that there are, like you say, fewer insects. And this is one of the changes. It's a worrying change because, of course, insects have a major role in the biological world. Without insects, or with fewer insects, a lot of processes, including the flowering of plants and so on, hardly possible.
It gives me the sense that we are living in a very, very difficult time. We're on the edge of one. Finally, what is your advice to the world, to all of us? I mean, what do we need to do? Where do we go with this? And for several months now, as a result of this virus, we have seen a radical decrease in emissions. Again, on my walk today, I didn't see a single jet trail, vapor trail in the sky, not one. Something I haven't seen since I was a child, or 9/11. You know, if we were to stay in this kind of frozen position, is this a start? I mean, where do we go? What do we do?
Well, if civilization continues to dig and burn and meet hundreds of billions of tons of carbon from the Earth's crust and release it into the atmosphere, civilization is changing what I would call the lungs of the Earth. If we breathe, which we do, higher concentration of carbon dioxide, we get very sick. It's called hypercapnia. That's the ratio of carbon dioxide to oxygen. The same goes for the entire Earth. The changing composition of the atmosphere is affecting the biosphere, whether it's plants or insects or animals. What do we do? Well, if the virus is going to end up making millions of people sick, which it does, then such an extreme change in the climate that we are witnessing now would make billions of people sick. What do we do? Well, we need to recognize that it is a crisis. It's a crisis in the living world. And we need to elect governments which recognize it's a climate and do everything possible to try and ameliorate it. The carbon dioxide concentrating in the atmosphere is already so high. It's higher by more than 40% than it was in pre-industrial times. That it's not only that we need to reduce emissions, we need also to somehow draw down of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, sequester carbon dioxide from the atmosphere, as it's causing amplifying feedbacks from land and from ocean. If we can elect governments which understand it and act upon it, then we can try and reduce the damage. But at the moment, I don't feel particularly optimistic about it.
Dr. Andrew Glickson with Australian National University, thank you so much for being with us. In this week's Geeky Science, on the line with us is Dr. Justin Frank, MD, psychoanalyst, clinical professor at the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Science at George Washington University Medical School, author of Trump on the Couch, previously Obama and Bush on the Couch. Justin Frank, MD, his Twitter handle. And Dr. Frank, welcome back to the program. I'm curious, we were just talking with Alex Lawson a moment ago from Social Security Works, and he was pointing out that yesterday at 5 o'clock, the Trump administration announced that if you earn so little money that you don't file taxes, income taxes, you have until noon tomorrow to go to an obscure site on the Social Security website and register yourself to get the $500 check for your kids, or you have to wait for a full year. And I was like, Alex, why would they do this? And he was like, as far as I can tell, it's malice. Tell me about this. How does malice play out in politics, and where is this coming from?
Wow. Malice plays out in the life of Donald Trump from his earliest childhood, so it precedes politics. Basically, his father was a tyrant, and he made the children obey him no matter what. And Donald wrote, as a child, he learned to watch his father abuse and browbeat his older brother and decided he would never confront his father and always do what he said. When he became a father, he was a tyrant with his own children. And he became a successful tyrant as a politician because look at what he's done to the Republican Party. They are afraid of any kind of tweet that will affect them or will hurt them. They are terrified of him. They've been terrified of him since the days of the primary campaign in 2016. They've never confronted him. However, that's where the malice comes in. It's about tyranny, and his malice is about tyrannizing others. The second part of his malice is that he came to office as a builder, but he also has a long history of being a destroyer. And the part of him that's the destroyer, he even destroyed many of his own projects, is something that is stronger than his ability to be a builder. So he's always had an internal struggle between a destructive part of his personality and the building part of his personality. And I think the destructive part of his personality has been winning out, and that it is malice about the checks not going out to the people who need them most. So it's about malice, it's about power, it's about tyranny.
We talked with Angelo Carasone, who is the president of Media Matters, and they monitor Fox News. And he was talking about how Fox News on April 7 and 8, as I recall, changed the narrative. They used to deny that the COVID was a threat. And then when it became undeniable, you know, New York was melting down, people were dying, they changed it to, yeah, okay, it's a threat, but it's not that big a deal. And then on the 7th or 8th, as I recall, they shifted the narrative again to, okay, we've done what needs to be done. Now we need to get America back to work, flying in the face of all the facts and creating a public health disaster. And I asked him, why would Lachlan and Rupert Murdoch be doing this kind of thing? You know, this kind of puppet master with these millions of, you know, the average age of Fox News viewers is from the high 60s, low 70s. These are the most vulnerable people to this particular disease. Why would they be doing this? And his response was that as far as he can tell, well, number one, Fox makes a lot of money doing this. But even if they lost all their advertisers, because you said they lost $300 million in advertising last year. It's about power. And so then my question was, well, why do people, you know, typically people want power for one of two reasons, either because they want to accomplish something like, hey, we want these politicians in power. You know, we want to have power over them so we can get tax breaks, or to make themselves feel secure. And at that point, he wasn't really sure where to go with that. I put that question to you. Why are these guys so tenaciously hanging on to power like this, even when the exercise of it, the way that they're doing it, is leading to the deaths of people?
Well, I don't know enough about Fox News, but I do know that Trump hangs on to power because that's the only way he can manage. And he can manage that way because that's how he learned to be from his father, that he has to stay in power or else he's in danger. And that he has a worldview that he's written about that's very clear, that the world is a dangerous place and people are out to get you. So he would say, there's a dangerous world, everyone is lied to, and most likely everyone is lying. So the ability to get away with lying in such a world is the source of comfort. So part of the power that he has is he needs to feel safe. And if he can feel safe by lying, by being more powerful than anybody else, he has a sense of omnipotence. And that's always worked in his rallies. People feel stronger in his rallies. People don't feel that they're being lied to. People feel increased. But what's happening now, and what happens with a person like Trump, who is a liar, is that liars have to rely on somebody else because they actually don't know the truth and they don't understand truth. So he has learned to rely on Fox News, which he feels is the truth. He's sort of a poor man's version, or a rich man's version, I guess, of Chauncey Gardner, if you remember from the movie Being There, when he knew all he knew was what he watched on television. And he would quote things from television, and people made him president of the United States in that story. This is Donald Trump, who is now the president, and he quotes whatever is on Fox News because that's the source of truth. People who chronically lie have a tremendous inability to know what's true, and they end up not only attacking truth, which is what Trump does, they end up actually de-skilling themselves. They are less and less able to think, less and less able to think clearly, and less able to plan because they have never pursued truth at all. So their mind has sort of shrunk in size, and he is a very good example of that. He's able to interact with people when they question him, but most of the interaction is based on attacking back and vague platitudes. He's not.
Well, I have a question about that. A number of, in particular, women reporters have gone after Donald Trump in the press conferences or in his daily rally there. How best should you confront Donald Trump?
You have to confront him all the time. Every time he says something, question what he says, and then question it again when he answers vaguely. The hardest part is a follow-up question for him, because he cuts off follow-up questions because he is too afraid. He's much more afraid of women than he is of men, and he is.
Remarkable. Dr. Justin Frank, George Washington University, author of Trump on the Couch, along with Bush and Obama on the Couch. Justin Frank, MD, is his Twitter handle. Dr. Frank, thank you again for dropping by. It's always great talking with you.
Thank you.
Sponsoring the interview this week is New Leaf Natural CBD Oil. Boy, with all this flying around, you know, I have been doubling my CBD oil dose. I love CBD oil. It doesn't get you high, but it's non-toxic, but it's a potent pain reliever. And it has potent pain relieving and anti-inflammatory properties, I think is the proper way to say that. And the brand I trust the most is New Leaf Naturals. NU Leaf Naturals CBD oil is the highest quality CBD oil on the market. It's 100% organic, highly concentrated, has no additional additives, grown in the USA, and the only ingredient is hemp. So the product remains in its most pure and simple form. Go to newleafnaturals.com. That's NUleafNaturals.com and save 30% off and get free shipping in the U.S. When you use the code TOM, it's spelled T-H-O-M. Go to NuLeafNaturals.com. For premium cannabinoid wellness, there's only one place, NuLeafNaturals.com. That's NuLeafNaturals.com. That's NuLeafNaturals.com. Code TOM, it's spelled T-H-O-M. NuLeafNaturals.com. Tom Hartman here with you, and on the line with us is Greg Palast, the author of several New York Times bestsellers, including The Best Democracy Money Can Buy. And you know him through his work with BBC Television, The Guardian, Democracy Now!, Rolling Stone. His new book, How Trump Stole 2020, will be out June 2nd. It's available for pre-order now. And GregPalast.com is his website. You can tweet him at Greg_Palast. Greg, welcome back. And tell us about Deepwater Horizon.
Okay. Forget the idea that it's an accident. I investigated the Deepwater Horizon for Channel 4 Television of Britain and the Big Arte system of Europe, and I did a whole feature-length film. What happened was 17 months before the Deepwater Horizon exploded, which they said had never happened. They never had a blowout before in an offshore deepwater drill. But 17 months before, they had almost BP, had almost an identical blowout in the Caspian Sea, same ocean rig, a transocean deep water rig. They covered it up, okay? They covered it up, and then David Rainey, their vice president, 9 months before the Deepwater Horizon blew out, he testified before Congress, Tom. The vice president of BP said that they've never had an unsafe situation at an offshore deep water drilling platform, never in 50 years. And it was just months earlier that they had a massive blowout in the Caspian, which was covered up. And by the way, they got help. And now I only know about this, by the way, Tom, because I got literally an insider at BP who is on the rig next to the one that blew out in the Caspian Sea. I flew to the Caspian Sea to confirm that this happened. I got arrested there, but then was kind of catch and release because I was a British reporter at the time. And they had this blowout and BP covered up. But they also, so I not only had that insider, but another insider named Chelsea Manning, who obtained the cables from the U.S. State Department, in which the State Department knew about the blowout, kept it secret, did not tell the U.S. Interior Department, which they must do by law. And that's how the Deepwater Horizon got its permit to drill. They had just started drilling, and they only got it over objection of the Interior Department, which said, this is unsafe. They said, no, we've always been safe, and Congress forced them to allow that drilling. 11 men were incinerated, 600 miles of coastline destroyed. That's the real story.
And that was 10 years ago right now?
10 years ago today was the Deepwater Horizon blowout. And, you know, again, it's always been, you know, it's an act of nature. There were mistakes made at the drill. A lot of course, all the safety equipment was missing. I have to tell you that part of my investigation went up to Alaska because, you know, I was the chief investigator on the Exxon Valdez case. This was before I was a journalist for fraud charges brought by the natives of Alaska. And BP was actually in charge, supposed to prevent that spill of the Exxon Valdez. Exxon, because it had its name on the boat, got all the blame, but BP was more to blame. They didn't have any cleanup equipment there, which they had promised to have, which they'd signed off and said they had, and then they pulled the same stunt in the Gulf. So from basically 20 years later, we had the Deepwater Horizon. They'd covered up the Caspian Sea blowout, of course. So you've got a multiple, you know, a recidivist environmental killer out there, British Petroleum. Mm-hmm. And as we remember this day 10 years ago, let's not forget they're still out there and nothing's improved.
That's amazing. So, Greg, one of the stories that keeps popping up with annoying mm-hmm. regularity and has for the last 3 years is how Donald Trump and his administration, I mean, he's put a coal executive in charge of the EPA, a coal lobbyist in charge of the Interior Department, how these guys keep undoing not just Obama-era regulations, but in some cases regulations that go all the way back to Nixon. As a consequence of that, is the next BP Deepwater Horizon blowout kind of event more likely now?
Absolutely, because we are not enforcing. You know, there's a lot of oil spills, Tom, and it's actually pretty easy to stop them. You basically surround them with rubber, and you suck. You get the sucker ships, or the containment ships, as they call them. But you have to have that equipment in place, and it costs literally billions for BP to live up to its agreements for the Gulf and its agreements for Alaska, and they've never lived up to those agreements. There was no reason why that when that, first of all, they shouldn't ever have used the system that they used, which is nitrogen-laced quick-dry cement that still is not prohibited. And that's how it blew out in the Caspian. That's how it blew out at the Deepwater Horizon. They're plugging these holes with this quick-dry cement. They put nitrogen in it, and on the deepwater wells, there's a lot of pressure. So it's like kind of blowing into a milkshake. You're going to create bubbles, and that's your blowout. So we still have these massive problems. We still have oil companies that really couldn't care if their rig workers get blown to kingdom come. It's just, you know, in the end, cheaper for them to pay people off and pay up the cleanup than the literally billions of dollars they'd have to spend each year to keep drilling even close to safe. It's madness to be drilling deep water in the Gulf anyway, and that's still continuing.
Amazing. Yeah. Remarkable. To the topic of your new book, How Trump Stole 2020, I know we talked about this last week, but you had this web event on Saturday over on, Facebook, kind of
with
me,
Hartman,
kind of rolling out your new book.
And you can still pick up your statements at Greg Palast Investigates. By the way, 7 p.m. tonight, we'll have another live, but on the Deepwater Horizon and Big Oil. 6
cool.
p.m. Pacific.
Cool. So I'm wondering if anything has changed. Are we seeing any motion by Democrats, or for that matter, blocking motions by Republicans that may have to do or may influence how the election this fall plays out? And also, what's going on with the primaries between now and then?
Well, I mean, the primaries are pretty much dead. But what I'm very, very concerned about is that the GOP is making no concessions for the fact that we are under lockdown and that their systems of forcing elections, in-precinct elections, literally are going to, that's going to kill people. Or in their hope, will chase people away. That's what they hoped would happen in Milwaukee.
Well, we are. Over the last 5-6 days, we've seen a substantial uptick in new COVID infections in Wisconsin, you know, following the voting debacle in Wisconsin. So apparently that actually is, you know, the Republicans forcing that and the Supreme Court and the Wisconsin Supreme Court is actually going to result in some people in Wisconsin dying. The Republicans
absolutely
are still committed
to this
path.
All for a single reason, Tom. They wanted to get this right-wing guy, judge, back on the Wisconsin State Supreme Court. By the way, he lost.
Right, Kelly.
But guess what? He's unrecusing himself, and even though he's been thrown out of office, he doesn't leave till August. He says he is now going to rule on whether 250,000 Wisconsin citizens should be removed from the voter rolls. Now, I just investigated that, and I can tell you, Tom, that list is phony as a $3 bill. My team has found 170,000 people wrongly placed on that list, including, they said that the Saquana Taylor, this African-American woman, had moved out of Milwaukee, so she's not allowed to vote there, except that I don't think so. She is the county supervisor of Milwaukee. This is the games that they're playing. This is the game, but it's horrible. It's 250,000 people, Tom. And remember that Agent Orange won that state by just 22,000 votes.
Yeah. They're getting ready.
We can steal it back.
The great Greg Palast. GregPalast.com is the website. You can tweet him at Greg_Palast. Greg, thanks for dropping by.
You're the best, Tom. Thank you, Mike.
Check out his new book, How Trump Stole 2020. It's available for pre-order right now, and I believe the electronic versions are available wherever you find fine books. That's all for this week's Science Revolution. You can find the video portions of the Science Revolution on YouTube and check out our Facebook page.
One, two, three, four. Those are numbers, but you already knew that. If you want to know what number you're going to pay each month for your car, use Kelley Blue Book My Wallet on AutoTrader. They're really good at numbers. AutoTrader.